Now we'll continue with questions. And I want to offer Imam Yama the opportunity to ask questions of us and have maybe a dual way dialogue to see if he has any to ask us as well. So, welcome back, Imam. And question? Oh, yes. Thank you, Tom. Questions, please, to the microphone so it gets recorded for those who can listen later online.
Last week we had a priest, and we were talking about the pedophiles, and all priests carry, to some extent, the pedophile priest, to carry the cross. So, for a moderate Muslim, you carry the burden of those Muslims who have become very violent. Do you carry the burden? And sometimes, are you considered one of them?
Yeah. Good question. One I was anticipating.
Yes.
In terms of bearing the burden, I think there's two ways of looking at it. One is the Quran mentions, no soul shall bear the burden of another soul. Everyone will be responsible equally with God. What your father does not necessarily affect you, and what your son does not necessarily affect you. How it does affect me, of course, is that in America, Muslims, as you probably can imagine, are very discriminated against in our travels. Obviously, when I travel, I'm always randomly selected for searches. I'm often asked lots of questions. Where have I gone? What do you teach? Say, I teach children. What do you teach children? Said, peace and love and how to read the Quran. It's not very theological with young children. So, of course, and we have a problem because in America with law enforcement and others, they have a difficult time trying to sift through who's moderate and who's extremist. We know by the numbers, the percentage of extremist elements amongst Muslims who claim they're Muslims are less than 0.001%. Unfortunately, 99.99%, that's an actual figure, have to deal with what the 0.001% are doing, unfortunately. And one, I blame a little bit the media for not being a little more just on this issue and not bringing in the other voice, the mainstream voice of Islam. I didn't mention where I was blessed to study Islam. I mostly studied Islam and I am studying Islam in America. One of my teachers is Hamza Yusuf Hansen, who is the founder of the first Muslim seminary college in America. He was an advisor to George Bush after 9/11. He's an American convert, scholar, and he goes throughout the world, both in the Muslim world and here in America, always teaching about what real mainstream Islam says. Unfortunately, because of the media and others, and because it's so powerful, the images we see, the one problem that is affecting a lot of us is that we haven't met Muslims. Or a lot of you think you didn't meet a Muslim, but there's Muslims in Sansom Clinic. There's Muslims who are lawyers. There's Muslims who are engineers who are building most of 217 out in Goleta, who build most of what you see around town, the bridge over down by Bath and Dera Gera down there. There's so much that are Muslim, but what does it mean to be a Muslim? They don't always look like me. This young gentleman here is a Hispanic Muslim. You would never know. His name is not Muhammad, it's Hernan. It's a Spanish name. Nor are you told to carry Arabic names. My dear friend Brendan in our community is a white American. So who is a Muslim? How would you know? You're not going to know. There's not a particular dress. I'm wearing a jacket from Banana Republic and a scarf from Banana Republic. Actually, my pants are from Banana Republic and my shirt is from Banana Republic. But you might look and you might say, hey, that's a Muslim dress. Rather, The owners are mostly Jewish. I love their clothes, though. Wonderful clothes. It shows compassion that we should not look to a religion before we buy some product. It's the product. We look at the quality. This is one problem we have. Stereotypes, prejudices, discrimination. It's gone really bad where I've been held up 3 hours at a border with my family, my wife, my children. And you know, what bothers me is the same questions every time. And sometimes you're frustrated because you say, you got to have a system where we can't do this every time. You ask me the same questions. Reason why is my wife's from Vancouver, Canada, so I travel there a lot. So every year I go through this. Things have got a little better, but for a lot of Muslims also, things are not as easy. Even a gentleman who is sitting here was not allowed to fly so easily and cause problems. And that's a lot of Muslims you'll meet. Unless their name is an American name with real no connection, nobody knows they go to the mosque. Often, I tell converts a lot of times, don't change your name unless you want to wait for 4 hours at the airport. There's no need to change your name. If you have a nice name, keep your name. Right? And people that convert, I always tell them, just keep your name. You can have a nickname if you like, makes you feel happy, or named after people that have significant meaning, but you are who you are. My name, Yama, is not Arabic. Every time I meet Arabs, I tell them my name is Yama, and they look at me, you're trying to connect it with Arabic. I said, it's not Arabic. Then they said, well, what is it? I said, it's Afghani. Well, what does it mean? I like to use the Japanese meaning of my name, which means mountain. Then they're confused. What do names have to do with realities of who you are? Basically is what I'm trying to say. So, things are tough, I'll be honest with you. Things are really bad for Muslims in this country right now. Although I like to stay optimistic and hoping things will get better, there's a lot of people really pushing this, making people fear Muslims and Islam. They're all real terrorists. They're just hiding their way. They've invented nice terms that they pulled out of certain sects of Islam called taqiyya. They can lie to you and it's part of their faith. This is unbelievable. For a Muslim, how do you defend that? If you're Christian or Jewish and you're in a Muslim country and they say, oh, they can lie, it's permissible in their religion, imagine how upset you'd be. It's very frustrating. What frustrates me a lot of times is the lack of Islam in so-called people who call themselves Muslims. If the Prophet didn't harm creatures and didn't harm others, how can you go not just harm yourself by killing yourself, but harming others? And we see this is like, I consider, the cancer of our society. There's something wrong with the immune system. Something went wrong to produce this. In order for us, I believe personally, to cure a lot of extremism, we need to spread education. Education needs to be funded more in Muslim countries, because it's lack of education that the impoverished and those who have nowhere to go are offered money and a way out and brainwashed. This is the problem. No one wants to address it. You can take out as many terrorists as you want, more will spring up and we'll keep doing it. Unless you rid out the cause. The cause is ignorance. It's being not educated in what Islam has to teach. I guarantee you, if you meet one of the imams or mullahs of the Taliban and you ask them five fundamental questions, basic questions about Islam, they will not be able to tell you. They're only trained with a very limited understanding of what those above them want to teach them. And they don't even know who's above them, one after another. They know that their leader is somewhere up there, but they've never met them and they don't know. I've actually met some when I was on pilgrimage. I said, why do you guys do this? We here in America, you're crazy doing this stuff. Is this true? He said, some of us are doing that. So not some of you. We see that this is a lot. What's the problem? He said, I don't know where the problem comes from. It's on top. So it's education. I have a dear friend who studied in Yemen with Habib Omar, the great spiritual scholar. He went to Afghanistan to teach there. The first year he had 200 students. Second year, 1,000. Third year, around 2,000 plus. Because everybody was drawn to the Sufism and the real Islam that they're being taught. His friend walked an hour every single day in the cold winter to go teach women in a village because they were not allowed to come out and go learn. He wrote to us, part of the email group that he sends out, that these women did not know the very creed of Islam, what La ilaha illallah, there is no God but God, means. They didn't know how to pray. They're kept from education. They're kept from going out. They're kept from all these things. The Prophet said, do not stop your women from going to the mosque. This is his commandment. You cannot force people to do anything in Islam. You cannot force people to believe. In chapter 2, verse 256 in the Quran, says clearly, La ikraha fi din, there's no compulsion in religion. You cannot, and to quote my teacher Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, he says, everyone loves chocolate, but not everyone loves it shoved down their throat. This is not the way. It's not the way of the Prophet. Prophet let people work on their own spiritual connection with God. There was a man who used to drink alcohol. And in Islam, drinking alcohol is not very good for you. It's one of the things you want to stay away from. This man was drinking alcohol and he was praying. So a companion complained to the Prophet, look at this man, Prophet of God. He drinks and he prays. Like, what kind of Muslim is this? And he said, that's between him and God. Leave him, for his prayer will strengthen him. You wait for people to develop. You give people chances to better themselves. But this person who teaches in Afghanistan now, he's running out of teachers. He's reaching out to others. You think I want to go to Afghanistan to teach? Unless I get a letter from a president that gives me full clearance to go, maybe I'll go, but then I have to worry about people killing me because I'm from America and it's a sin to live in America. And you're a moderate and Muslims aren't moderate. This is the kind of rubbish, to quote the English, they use. This is unacceptable. And mainstream Islam, thank God, are all moderate. There are extremist elements and there are imams, so-called imams, in England. Mostly America, they don't tolerate this at all. England does tolerate a lot. And those imams should be very... It's really puzzling that they're going out and they're preaching against the West and they're preaching in all this, and meanwhile you're living in the country and taking welfare. It doesn't make any sense. It's ridiculous. These people are often not educated. If you look at who they studied with, they didn't study with anybody. Who did Osama bin Laden study with? No one. He's an accountant. He's not a Muslim scholar. And certainly, you can bet he didn't spend time with the Sufi scholars. And certainly, I don't think that the first tradition of the Prophet he heard was the most merciful, show mercy on those on earth and you'll be shown mercy from the heavens. I don't think that's what he learned. Which brings our point, and I think with my short talk, I'm able to probably answer a lot of questions you have. In Saudi Arabia, it's a very nice country, and I'm often very critical of Saudi Arabia, and I get in a lot of trouble, but you have to tell the truth as it is. Saudi Arabia has a type of approach recently with Islam that's very dry. They're not very sympathetic or open to Sufism. In fact, if you're an open practicing Sufi scholar in Saudi Arabia, you'll be jailed. They will not allow you to have a voice. This, you can understand, has caused the types of voices, the type of understanding of extremism that has come out of Saudi Arabia. Pakistan. I have a friend here who's a PhD in political science and specialist in Islamic extremism. Here in Santa Barbara, on a one-year study, recently was in the Pentagon and briefed the high officials that the problem is there are certain countries that are really problematic and there's not enough done in those countries to educate, to bring back balance and moderation, as is present in Malaysia, as is present in many other parts of the Muslim countries. Now we have these extremists popping up everywhere. In Syria, in Africa, where we saw these crazy people holding up people in the mall. And when I was reading about them, I was trying to understand what is these guys' justification. They use a verse out of the Quran, which is so scary, which says, return, do unto others as they do unto you. They take this, you know how they take it? They're killing us, they're bombing us, we're going to do the same. They kill innocents, we'll kill innocent people. If you have this type of mentality, God help us. Because then what happens when you use justification? And one of the justifications he used for that verse is one of the top clerics of Saudi Arabia. Top cleric. There's no criticism here. It's all tolerated. As Muslims, I get very, very frustrated personally when I see a top cleric of Saudi Arabia saying to destroy churches. And it takes another top cleric of Turkey to condemn his words and his actions. But where does that come from? We need to raise an awareness of moderate Islam, Sufism, what is missing. All the main branches right now If you look at the terminology they use, they call it Salafist movements. What is Salafist? They are a new sect of Islam that have branched out and consider Main Street sellouts and lost people. This is what they are. They've taken the law into their own hand. The four schools of Sunni mainstream traditional Islam of over 90% of Muslims, all four schools condemn suicide bombing, forbid suicide bombing, and not just suicide bombing, killing yourself in any case. They had a debate in early Islam about what if there's a fire on a boat and you're on a boat and you can't get out. Should you jump into the water or should you stay on the boat? Imagine this debate. Some said if you stay on the boat, then it's the will of God. Boat burned and you died in it, incidentally. Others said if you jump into the ocean, you are making the conscious choice of jumping in. Therefore, it's your option. You might die. Of course, some of us might say, this is ridiculous. Just, you know, if you're going to die, jump in. We would take that position, I'm sure. But look at the concern that they had. Then what gives you the idea that it's okay to blow yourself up? That it's okay to kill others and kill Muslims and kill anyone? I would be attacked in Afghanistan by the Taliban just by what I wear. I'm not kidding you. Because I, and Boko Haram and Nigeria as well, these people are just judging you by your outward appearance. They're not being in line with the prophetic tradition that says God does not look at your outward forms and your appearance, but looks at your heart. And who gave you the role of God to judge who's on which point and who's not? You see, this is the danger today. Unfortunately, what I can do as a Muslim, I can come to places like this and share with you that this is not my Islam, and it's not the Islam of my friends here, and it's not the Islam of our communities here in America, for the most part. We have within Muslims frustration, and we seek how we can calm this down by making them understand the way of Ahmed Bamba, that everything is from God. Play your role. Be patient, as the Prophet was in Mecca. Embody mercy, embody compassion, and you will see God will change your condition over time. This is the way to do it. And the Prophet said there will come a time where there will be so much killing and strife that the only way to save your religion is go out to the desert. Don't fight anyone. And hold on to the tree until death comes to you. Don't be involved in strife. Don't be involved in killing. Don't be involved in all this, which is happening. Syria's civil war right now is bringing in Muslims from all over the country who believe they're fighting a jihad. This is not jihad. Civil strife. And this is what the Prophet said, there will come a time where the man sitting will be better than the man walking. That those that are less involved, they'll be the better people. And so, God willing, I'll try to cover more aspects, but I think from the extremist level, you see what is happening. It's a lack of education. It's being people that have a lot of money as Bin Laden. The Laden family in Saudi Arabia is the second richest. They've got lots of children. Each child has hundreds of millions of dollars, roughly. They're very rich. So when you have a lot of money, I can go in anywhere and I can brainwash somebody just because there's no education. So we need imams and spiritual guides and scholars at every place to control and bring down peace and understanding and teach the real Islam. Otherwise, I'm afraid we're going to lose lots of our women and men and women in our armies and our military who are going to go and they're trying to get college educations and they're trying to live lives and they're going through lots of post-traumatic syndrome. They're going through a lot of hardship. And then after 10 years of war, we go, what are we trying to do? Oh, I get it. We're trying to get Bin Laden. But we got him. What are we trying to do now? Why did we go into Afghanistan and Iraq? We're trying to get extremists, but they're in Nigeria, and they're in Africa, and they're in Syria, and they're in Libya, and they're everywhere. What do we do? You see, this is why it's a problem. We all have to work together in bringing an end to this type of extremism, and we have to use Muslims, because it comes from us in the sense that they claim they're Muslims. So we would have an advantage of dealing with them first, and then others. So we can just pray and ask God Almighty to change the hearts of people and to educate them. That's all we can do. But I can tell you that the majority of Muslim communities and the majority of the 6 million, they say, every Muslim I know has 3-4 kids. That was the figure 15, 12 years ago, 6 million. There's got to be 8 to 10 million Muslims in this country. Every day is a day of peace. We don't see any type of extremism except a few that we've seen. But can we also say that this is not the case with other religions and other people? Only they don't do it in the name of religion. But their religion, our religion does not say you can do these things. But if you want to interpret anything out of place, if you want to take anything to be whatever you want it to be, you can do that. You can do that with the Bible. You can do that with the Quran. The real reason is you're lacking compassion. You're lacking mercy. And this is what it's all about. And this is the main problem. So we would say in the Arabic, lacking rahmah, lacking this mercy that the Prophet said, Ana innama ana rahmatan muhda. I am but a gift of mercy. And that's very far from his teaching.
I just want to bring it closer to home with this question, actually this comment, and maybe you could expand on it. We share our Abrahamic origins with also our Jewish brothers and sisters. I found it astounding and beautiful that there are more words about Mary, the mother of Jesus, in the Quran than in the Bible. And in fact, in the Quran, an entire chapter or book is about Mary, the mother of Jesus. I thought that was astounding. So,
Jesus, peace be upon him, we call him Isa ibn Maryam, and I know that many of you have very special feelings about Jesus. One thing we can agree is we all love him, and we all believe in him as being one of the people of God. If I always tell people, if I met Jesus, I would not hesitate to kiss his hand and his feet because he's one of the people of God, sent by God. No problem for me, absolutely. The mother of Jesus is very special because she's an example for both men and women in the Quran. Chapter 19 is named after Mary. And the story is very beautiful. Mary, as you guys know the tradition, she grew up very special with her mother Hannah, who before that vowed to have a child for the sake of God, who's going to take over the covenant and who's going to worship God and be a great leader, etc. But when she had Mary, in the Quran it says, "My Lord, but I had a daughter." She was trying to have a son. This is Hannah, the mother of Mary. And the Quran says, "Laysa dhakara kal unta." The male is not like the female. The male you thought you're going to have is not like this female. This female is better than the male that you thought you were going to have. That's the beauty of the Quran. Now, Mary then was prepared to have Jesus. And in the Quran, you will never see Isa said this, Jesus. It's always Jesus, the son of Mary. Because that's an honor. From our perspective, it's an honor that not only is he special, but who is he the son of? Mary. And the whole family of Mary is honored in the Quran in the third chapter, which is called Ali Imran, the family of Imran. And the Quran gives a beautiful story of how the angel came and spoke to her, which then became proof for the Islamic theologians a woman can be a prophet. Because how is she talking to Gabriel one-on-one? Only a prophet talks to an angel. So she has full conversation, and one of the great scholars, Qadi Abu Bakr ibn al-Arabi, one of the great Andalusian old Spain Muslim scholars, he said, this is proof she's a prophet. And she used to get fruits out of season. Zechariah, who's also our prophet, he comes in and he says, where'd you get this from? This is out of season fruits. Doors are closed. No one was here. She said, this is from my Lord. It's a gift. And then, of course, we also have in our tradition that Jesus spoke in the cradle as a young child, because they accused an Islamic understanding Mary of adultery, and then she just pointed to him and he spoke and he said, Inni Abdullah, I am the servant of God. Atani al-kitab wal-hikmah. He's given me the knowledge and the wisdom. And he taught me the Torah and the Torah. And he's made me a giver of glad tidings. Peace be upon me the day that I'm born, the day that I pass away and the day that I return. So this is a very special prophet. It's a special theme. And talking about Mary, we have to talk about women. Empowering women. I will say that in the Islamic tradition, my understanding is a man is not better than a woman. Nor is a woman better than a man, except in their own personal piety with God. not with anybody else. And this is what our tradition is. A woman who takes care of her children and often, classically, did her chores, is in jihad in the way of God. And this word jihad, as you notice, every time the media wants to scare you, they're not going to throw you the English translation. So the struggle for God's cause, this is very strange, isn't it, Bob? And it's a danger, isn't it? But when they change it to this, well, the jihad that these Muslims, all of a sudden you already have a fear because it's the unknown. The cousin of the Prophet Ali said, you tend to fear what you do not know. So they type to use words. If you go jihad, do you know in the Quran it says, those who do jihad against God, God will guide you? It's the same word. وَالَّذِينَ جَاهَدُوا فِينَا Those who do jihad against us, against God. What do you mean against God? Because it's talking about struggle. Those who struggle for my cause, I will guide them into different paths of guidance. See that? Same word. So media does that a lot. But anyway, talking about women. Women are to be honored and respected. There's a chapter in the Quran called the women. There is no chapter called the men. I'm sorry for... we'll discuss that. Perhaps this may be...
I was just going to ask about jihad. And I was going to start by saying that we have a friend of Iranian extraction. He's a musician, so he goes by the name Jazz. But his real name is... jihad, which right. He can't use. So I was going to ask you for the positive meaning of that word.
This is what it is. It comes from jahada, to struggle. It's funny that that's what... jahada means to struggle. I say, you know what our jihad is? Waking up early in the morning. Absolutely. You have children, getting your children ready is jihad. I'm being quite serious that this is jihad. A woman to make her husband breakfast. Her husband's not a nice guy. He doesn't deserve it. But she's like, you know what, honey, I'm going to be nice to you. I'm going to make you breakfast. This is her jihad. For a woman to cook and clean is her jihad. And do you know three of the four Islamic schools I mentioned of mainstream Sunnism, Sunni Islam, mainstream Islam? Three of the four says a woman does not have to, as an obligation, cook or clean. And she can even charge the man for giving milk to his child. It's his responsibility. So then you would ask, wow, then what does a woman do? Well, let's talk about what the man has to do. He has to provide her a house. He has to provide shelter. It gets deeper in Islamic law that when the winter comes, my wife's like, you need to buy me a winter jacket. I said, it is your right. I have to get your winter jacket. This is true. You have to get your kids winter jackets because these are their rights. And in Islamic tradition, God is putting the man responsible to provide all of that. He has to do everything. What does she have to do? Just be pretty, be humble, love and enjoy your life, be with your spouse. That's her role. But with women in the Quran mentioned a whole chapter after women, there's no chapter called the men. There's a problem with men creating their own chapter called the men, but there's no chapter called men. And this is because a lot of times women are very oppressed. One of the last advice that the Prophet gave right before he passed away on a Monday, he gave an advice and he said, your wives, your women has a right on you. And he passed away because he had a high fever. And he woke up again and he said, your women have rights upon you. Your women have rights upon you. Because he feared women will be subjugated and they will be not given their rights. Islam as a religion gave rights to women to own property, to engage their own marriage, to be in business, as was the wife of the Prophet Muhammad, Khadija. She was a businesswoman who employed him, who worked for her. She was very impressed with his character and she proposed to marry him, not the other way around. So in Islam, a woman could propose to a man. And it's not just a man could propose, but a woman could propose as well. This is the beauty of Islam. And then many of the other aspects, being involved in society, he had wives like Zainab, who was very involved in taking care of the poor and the needy. We can say this was a non-profit organization at that time of taking care of the needy and the communal needs. He had a wife who was in business. He had a wife who was a political advisor, who was Aisha, his young wife who was a scholar, who was incredibly pious. And we have all these models of Muslim importance of their role. And none of it that the Prophet said, this is wrong or don't do this and don't do that. But unfortunately in Muslim societies, yes, some Muslim societies, women are very oppressed. And once again, my country, Afghanistan, seems to be on the news quite a bit when it comes to women's roles, as I mentioned earlier. But this is the aggression, and this is transgression by some of the Muslims in that area, that they take away the right of women. For example, in Saudi Arabia, women cannot drive. Now you just do the math, okay? 1400 years ago, they didn't have any cars. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, there's no tradition, he says, women don't ride a car. His wives and others, they rode on camels and others. Where do you get that Islam does not allow women to drive? You're making up your own religion. And in Islam, you always have to have a proof from the Quran or the traditions of the Prophet for a legal position to be valid. So this is an example. And many examples that come up a lot, I'm asked about. You know, women's roles, women's subjugation. Do women have to wear the hijab in order to be a Muslim? Of course not. It's her own wearing the head cover. It's her own piety with God. I have relatives that don't wear it and they consider themselves Muslim and they pray. And Islamic theology does not take you out of Islam for what you don't practice. It's what you believe in. And your practice is with God. Perhaps you're deficient in one area, but you're very active and very successful in another. And when we have a tradition of the Prophet Muhammad that says that a prostitute once felt sorry for a dog and put water in her shoe and gave it to the dog, God forgave the prostitute because of the water she gave the dog. I think it gives you a pretty good idea. You got a pretty good chance.
First of all, I want to thank you for this wonderful
thank you. Thank you.
Talk.
Thank you.
I have two questions. The first question relates to what you said a few minutes ago about using the moderate Muslims. And this is what I have been thinking. I'm wondering whether there have been any attempts by the mainstream moderate Muslims to either to dialogue or to put pressure to dialogue and communicate with the more fundamentalist Muslims. It seems to me that it needs to come within your religion.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I've always wanted to know the answer to this. I read the Quran many years ago, and on several pages there was a phrase, "Down with the infidels," and I want to know what if you could explain what
sure.
that means.
Okay, so the first part of the question is, what are Muslims doing about this, and is there dialogue with them? To be honest, I'm not an expert in political aspects to see what involvement is taking place. Mostly, a lot of extremists, they understand the position of mainstream Islam, but they tend to reject it because of the frustration of what is happening politically. The scholars of Al-Azhar University, also very great, prominent Muslim scholars in different parts of the world, have gone to speak with people like the Taliban and advise them that what you're doing is not correct. Like when they bombed the Buddhist statues in Afghanistan, one of the great scholars, Yusuf al-Qaradawi, although he has some elements, but he went and he tried to advise them that this is wrong Islamically, you cannot do this. The Quran says do not insult or hurt anyone's worshipped gods or whatever they hold dear, because then they will do the same to your religion without knowledge. You're going to get what you're putting out. So, and the fact that it stayed there for thousands of years with all the Muslim rule of in the country for over 1,000 years, what gave you the audacity and the power or the authority to go do that? So, unfortunately, they are advised. Some, hopefully, are changing their mind. But the higher areas are really difficult to negotiate with, because they hold that negotiating, some of them, that negotiating is a type of selling out, not being true. So this is going to have to be through education. I wish they would come to a dialogue and debate. For example, our friend who went to Pakistan, the research scholar here, she met all the heads of all the movements in Pakistan. And she told them in one of her research papers, you know, I'm doing a research paper, if you can just please quote me one verse of the Quran that allows suicide bombing for my research. He said, oh, there's many, you know, killing yourself and killing others. And he said, there's many, I don't have time, which one? She said, you know, just for my paper, just give me one. I'm just looking for one. He said, oh, my aide will give it to you. He couldn't give one, because there is not one. The second question about down with the infidel, in the way that it is put, as you mentioned, the Quran talks about iman and kufr. Belief, bringing safety in believing in God. and also covering up what you know to be truth. The word kufr, which is the word they're translating for infidel, the word kufr in Arabic, we get cover in English from. It means to cover up what you know to be the truth. That is God's judgment. And it's not in this world, it's in the next world. That in the next world, on the Day of Judgment, Muslims believe every individual will be given personal judgment with God based on their evidence. In other words, God does not, on the Day of Judgment, out of His mercy and compassion, judge you with His knowledge. He doesn't bring you out and says, you know, I just think you're not worth it, I'm going to put you in hell. He doesn't do that. And the same in Islamic law, if a judge sees someone kill someone, say you saw him on the street, and then he goes to court, he cannot judge against that person because he knows, he saw. He can be a witness, but it's not a fair trial. God is so merciful that on the Day of Judgment, He judges like that, by the evidence, not by His knowledge. Because by His knowledge, will be done. But by the evidence, everything will bear witness for you. The ground that you commit sins on will bear witness against you if you didn't repent and turn to God. But if you did repent, then God turns your bad actions into good actions so that people say, I wish I did even more bad action. So it's not sinning that is necessarily our failure. We're going to commit some wrongs and sins. It's what we do after that makes us who we are. So I think if you're reading these terms, it has a exegesis involved, a commentary that is required for it. If you'd like, we can look at a passage that you may have in question. And if I know the commentary, then we can look at it. You have to be careful with one thing in the Quran. The Quran is a book of guidance, and there's over 6,000 verses. 500 deal with what they call ahkam shari'iyya, legal law. In other words, legal things that is used in proofs of Islamic law, such as pray, you know, wash before you pray, when you get divorced, do this, when you leave inheritance, do this. All those things are only 500 verses. 5,500 are dealing with stories of the prophets, spirituality. It's dealing with all those things. Only 500 out of the 6,000 are dealing with law. When you go into the law, it's problematic. The reason why is the law, the verses that deal with law are for the scholars. The deeply rooted first generation scholars. Why? Because each verse of the law has supplemental proofs and understandings from the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad. So that unless you have his tradition in his life to weigh under the context of what is being said, for example, in the Quran, in the science of the Quran, it talks about, was this a verse only for his situation or was it for all times? Was it a particular situation? Is this verse abrogated by another verse? For example, it says in the Quran, fight those of the idolaters who fight you. Okay, so should we go fight every idolater? It says in another verse, God commands you that if people do not kill you and drive you out from your land, that you are just and compassionate and merciful with them. So here we see a context. The first verse, which is in chapter 9 and often used by extremists and others, that it's just saying fight people. But this was a particular situation of the Prophet Muhammad when the tribes have rallied around him in the Arabian Peninsula. In this case, you're getting the state of peace and ease, and you know, when you have wasulhu khair, the Quran says negotiating, compromising on peace terms is good. When that fails and you have nothing, then there's rules of engagement in war. For example, a Muslim can never kill a child, can never fight and kill a woman, can never attack priests and rabbis and others like we're seeing in Syria, kidnapping monks, kidnapping Greek Orthodox and others, churches and their priests. Prophet forbade this. He only said, fight those who fight you in the battle like men, like proper, like the way of bravery in the old times, not cowardly. Now we would say dropping a bomb on a massive population of innocent people is completely against Islamic law. This is unjust. So everything has a context. What I would recommend is, when you see a verse, to look up the commentary on how did the Muslim scholars understand this and how does it apply in Islamic law. And unfortunately, we don't have the time, but this is a huge, huge aspect of our religion. One of the main problems we have with extremists. They do not apply the exegesis and the commentary, or look at Islamic law in the four schools. They do their own, without the qualification. That's the problem.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My question will be very light after that. But I thank you so much for coming to us and speaking.
Thank you.
This has been a great blessing to me.
Thank you.
One of the things that I read an article a long time ago, and it was talking about Muslim women who wear the hijab, mm-hmm. and how they that they felt our anger toward them, what you talked about, that frustration of people judging them.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my mind, you know, I'm a person who smiles a lot. I'm thinking, well, when I see a woman wearing the hijab, I will smile and greet her. And I could not get eye contact with any time that I saw them, which was, you know, in an airport or traveling. And so you gave me the answer to my dilemma, to say, peace be upon you.
That's wonderful.
And that way, when they hear peace be upon you, their eyes will come up and we can greet each other like we should be as sisters. So I thank you for that. I thank you for your
thank
kind
you.
And wonderful
That's great advice.
And very, smart and intellectual words too, but that touches our hearts.
Yeah, that's very beautiful what you said.
Thank
because
you.
Of that. Thank you. I think if you see a Muslim, my recommendation is just say hi and... And you will, honestly, because a lot of them are also need to be reminded of compassion. Like that Starbucks story, if you smile and just say hi, believe me, every Muslim will say, not every American hates us. And they will see the beauty in you as well.
Have we time for one more?
We thank
no.
Imam Yaman Niazi for his insights and thoughts. And I thank you all who welcome him and stretch your minds and hearts to new thinking that I hope will be passed on through Karin's work and all of you. Thanks. Peace be upon you.